Chapter 17. Linda Ross and Franklin Lincoln approached the archaeological camp on foot an hour before dawn. Both were operating on too much adrenaline and too little sleep. Murph had taken the pig off into the deep desert to rendezvous with George Adams, who was flying in the bladder of fuel they would need to complete their mission. No one liked the idea of splitting up. Finding only the one body near the drill truck and no sign of the other two Americans at the helicopter service area meant they had been taken elsewhere. The guess was wherever the Libyan cargo chopper had taken the chairman. If that were the case, their interrogation would be swift, brutal, and more than likely successful. Even now, a team of terrorists could be headed toward the archaeological dig in the MI-8 helicopter. But time was ticking down. The summit was fast approaching, and more important, the longer the secretary was held, the more likely she would be tortured as well. With the sun climbing the horizon, the camp began to stir. Linda and Link noted the archaeologists were mostly grad students spending a summer doing field work. There were a few older expedition members who they assumed were full professors and faculty advisors. The camp also supported a staff of roughly 10 native Tunisians, one of whom was dressed in an ill-fitting suit and looked agitated and did very little, so they assumed he was the government minder. They had to watch for nearly an hour before Dr. Emil Bumford emerged from his tent. For a man who had lost 3/4 of his team, the prissy doctor didn't appear overly upset. He yawned theatrically when he stepped into the sun, as if his sleep the night before had been untroubled. Wearing a ridiculous safari suit with a Panama hat, he ambled to the mess tent. Cooks worked over grills set behind the structure, and while the smell didn't carry to Linda or Link, both imagined the scent of eggs and country-fried potatoes. Their breakfast had been cold MREs. The meal went long. No doubt there had been a staff meeting after everyone ate. The students left the mess first, returning to their tents briefly to grab packs and hand tools and heading over a low rise to the Roman ruins. The teachers were a bit more leisurely, but they too vanished over the hills separating the camp from the archaeological site. Bumford returned to his quarters after all the others had gone to work. He was inside for only a minute before settling himself on a chair under a sunshade just outside his tent's entrance. The book he cracked open was easily as thick as an encyclopedia volume. Link wanted to sneak into the camp and grab Bumford now, but native workers were moving about, gathering laundry and tidying the students' tents.
"I took an archaeology class my junior year in college," Linda whispered. "We went on a dig for a long weekend. We never had servants like this."
"You didn't have the State Department pay an extra to let some of their people tag along."
"Good point. So what do you make of Bumford?"
"If I were to guess, I'd say he's making a healthy per diem being out here and is in no hurry to find out what happened to Alana Shepherd and the others."
"Nice," Linda said sarcastically.
The Tunisian representative approached Bumford about an hour after he'd settled into his chair. They spoke for only a moment. Bumford made elaborate gestures with his arms and ended the conversation with a nonchalant shrug. Link whispered in a thick, faintly Arabic accent,
"Professor Bumford, have you heard from your people?"
He then made his voice pinched and nasally.
"I have no idea what happened to them. Surely you have contacted your university and reported them missing."
"That isn't my responsibility. I am only here as a consultant."
"But aren't you concerned? They are several days overdue."
"Not my problem."
And local guy exits stage right.
Link's pantomime and prediction was spot on. Bumford didn't give the conversation a second's thought before returning to his book. They waited 20 more minutes for the camp to quiet down. The native staff was nowhere to be seen, so Link crept from his hiding place and threaded his way to the back of Bumford's tent. He slipped a knife from a deep pocket of his coveralls. It was an Emerson CQC-7A. The blade was so sharp that when he slit the nylon, it made no more sound than a knife cutting butter. Stepping silently into the tent, he crossed over to the entrance. Bumford's back was toward him, less than a foot away, and the man had no idea anyone was looking over his shoulder. Link glanced across to where Linda crouched behind barrels used to keep the camp's generator fueled. She held up a slim hand for Link to wait while one of the cooks crossed the compound, headed toward the pit latrine. As soon as he vanished, Linda clenched her fist. Link reached out and grabbed Bumford under his arms and heaved him into the tent in a fluid motion that sent the Ottoman specialist sprawling onto the dirt floor. Lincoln was on him like a dark wraith, one hand clamped over Bumford's mouth, the other poised with the knife so the portly professor could see it. A moment later, Linda stepped into the tent through the hole Link had cut.
"Damn, you made that look easy. He must weigh 250.
"Closer to 270. That was my variation on the clean and jerk. I call it heave the jerk." Linda hunkered low next to Bumford's head. The doctor's eyes were as big as saucers, and sweat beaded his domed forehead.
"My colleague is going to remove his hand. You are not going to move or cry out. Understand?"
Bumford lay there like a gutted fish.
"Nod if you understand."
When he still didn't move, Link prompted him by yanking his chin up and down. Bumford's eyelids fluttered as the first wave of terror ebbed, and he nodded vigorously. When Link pulled his hand away, Bumford whimpered,
"Who are you?" "Keep your voice down," Linda said. "We're here about Alana Shepherd, Mike Duncan, and Greg Chaffee."
"Who are you?" Bumford repeated. "I don't recognize you. You aren't part of this group."
When Linda reached across him, Bumford seemed to try to burrow into the ground. She straightened his glasses on the bridge of his nose and curled one of the spectacle's arms around his ear where it had dislodged.
"We're friends. We need to talk to you about the other members of your team."
"They aren't here."
"What is this guy, an idiot savant?" Link asked.
"Professor Bumford,"
Linda opened again as smoothly as she could.
"We're here to ask you a few questions. We're part of an American search and rescue team."
"Like the military?"
"Strictly contract civilians, but people in Washington thought your mission important enough to hire us."
"It's a waste of time," Bumford said, regaining a little of his equilibrium and his arrogance.
"Why do you say that?"
"You do know who I am, yes?"
Linda knew he was fishing for a little recognition to prime his ego.
"You're Emil Bumford, one of the world's foremost experts on the Ottoman Empire."
"Then you must know I needn't explain my opinions. You may take them as fact. This expedition for the State Department is a complete waste of time."
"Then why in the hell did you come?" Link asked. Bumford didn't answer right away, and Linda saw the furtive look in his eye.
"Don't lie," she cautioned.
With a sigh, Bumford said,
"I lost my tenure because of an affair with a student, and I'm now in the middle of a divorce. My soon-to-be ex-wife's lawyer is treating my wallet like a piñata, and I didn't make that much teaching in the first place. Add that to the fact that I haven't published a book in 10 years, and you figure it out."
"Money."
"The State Department is paying me $500 a day. I need it."
"That's why you're out here, sitting on your butt, even though the rest of your team is missing. You're just racking up your per diem."
There was neither denial nor shame in Bumford's expression. Linda wanted to slap his smug face, but instead said as calmly as she could,
"Well, it's time you start earning your money. Tell me exactly why you think this trip is a waste of time."
"Do you know the story of Suleiman al-Jama we were told? About how he befriended an American sailor and had a change of heart concerning his jihad against the West?"
"We've heard it," Linda said.
"I don't believe it. Not for a second. I've studied everything al-Jama ever wrote. It's almost as if I know the man. He wouldn't change. None of the Barbary corsairs would. They made too much money waging war against European shipping."
"I thought al-Jama fought for ideological reasons, not monetary gain," Link countered.
"Al-Jama was a man like any other. I'm certain he would have been tempted by the riches that raiding provided. He might have started off wanting to kill infidels for the sake of killing them, but in some of his later writings, he talks about the rewards he accumulated. His word, not mine. Reward doesn't necessarily mean treasure, Linda said, realizing that Bumford was interpreting Aljama through his own money-grubbing prism. Young lady, I was brought out here because I am the expert. If you don't care to listen to my explanations, please leave me be. I'm curious, Link said. Just how lucrative was piracy for the Barbary pirates? What do you really know of them?
I know the Marines kicked some butt like the song says, to the shores of Tripoli.
That was actually 500 mercenaries under the command of ex-American consul William Eaton and a handful of Marines who sacked the city of Dima, a backwater in the Bashaw of Tripoli's holdings. True, their action may have hastened a peace treaty, but it was far from a legendary battle worthy of a hymn.
Link had some Marine Corps friends who would have killed the man for such a remark.
Between the 15th and 19th centuries, Bumford continued, the Barbary pirates had a stranglehold on the most lucrative sea routes in the world, the Mediterranean and the North Atlantic coast of Europe. During that time, those nations that wouldn't or couldn't pay the exorbitant tributes had their shipping fall prey to the pirates. Their cargoes were stolen, and their crews either ransomed or sold into slavery. Nations like England, France, and Spain paid the pirates millions in gold to protect maritime commerce. For a time, even the United States was paying them. And by some accounts, more than a tenth of the federal revenue went to various Barbary Coast rulers. The pirates also went on raiding parties to kidnap people from seaside villages as far north as Ireland. By some estimates, more than 1.5 million Europeans were taken from their homes and sold into slavery. Can you imagine?
Yeah, Link said with a trace of irony.
Bumford had warmed to his subject and chose to ignore the African-American's jibe. We're talking about one of the preeminent naval powers of their time. And Suleiman al-Jama was perhaps the most successful and by far the most ruthless pirate of them all. Though he had first studied to be an imam, his family had a tradition of piracy that went back for generations. There are tales of his ancestors preying on ships returning from the Crusades. It was in al-Jama's blood. I'm sorry, but from what I know of him, he would never renounce what he saw as a holy war against the Western powers any more than the modern terrorist of the same name would. And Linda saw her mistake. His prism wasn't that of his own personal greed. He saw what they were trying to accomplish through the lens of the continuation of inevitable terrorism and the triumph of indefatigable Islamic dogma. She was speaking to a man defeated, a man who had never fired a shot in the war against extremists of a culture he professed to study but had never understood. She went on anyway. But this is when Thomas Jefferson decided the United States would no longer pay tribute. For the first time in their history, the pirates were facing a first-class navy that was willing to fight rather than hand over money. Surely al-Jama must have understood their free reign was over. Jefferson's unilateral declaration of war against piracy was the beginning of the end for them. One nation had taken a stance against their form of savagery, despite the rest of the world continuing to cower. Even as she said it, the parallels to the present struggle against terrorism sent a chill down her spine. Europe had spent the latter part of the 20th century living under the constant threat of terrorism. There had been bombings in nightclubs, kidnappings, assassinations, and hijackings all across the continent, with very little response from the authorities. The United States had taken a similar route following the first attack on the World Trade Center. The government had treated it as a criminal act rather than what it truly was, the opening salvo in a war. The perpetrators had been duly arrested and sent to prison, and the matter was largely forgotten until 9/11. Rather than ignore the truth for a second time, the government had responded to the 2001 attack by taking the fight back to any and all who supported terrorism in its many forms.
like it had chosen 200 years earlier, America had proclaimed to the world that it would rather fight than live in fear. Bumford said, "Even if I grant the possibility that Aljamrah had a change of heart and found ways to reconcile the differences between Islam and Christianity, there is the practical matter of finding his ship, the Sakhar. It is simply impossible that a vessel has remained hidden in the desert for 2 centuries. It would either have been destroyed by the elements or looted by nomads. Trust me, there is nothing left to find." For the sake of argument, Link cut in when he could tell Bumford's pessimism was about to make Linda snap. "If it somehow survived, would you have any clue where it might be?" "From the letter I read back in Washington, I do believe it must be on the dry riverbed to the south of us. But Alana, Mike, and Greg have scoured it completely. They stopped only when they came to a waterfall that, when the river was flowing, would have been impassable. There is no Barbary pirate ship hidden out there." "Was there any other clue in the letter? Something insignificant, even?" "Henry Lafayette said it was hidden in a large cavern that was accessible only through the use of, and I quote here, a clever device. Please don't ask me what that means. Alana pestered me for weeks on end about it. The only other thing I have is a local legend that the ship is hidden beneath the black that burns." "The what?" Linda asked. "The black that burns. The tale comes from the journal of Aljamrah's second-in-command, Suleiman Karamanli. It survived because he happened to be the Bashaw of Tripoli's nephew, so it was housed with the royal archives. What it means, I'm afraid, is beyond me. I am sorry." "So am I," Linda muttered. "If a trained archaeologist like Alana Shepherd couldn't find Aljamrah's ship after spending weeks using sophisticated equipment, there was little hope she and Mark and Link would discover it in the remaining days before the peace conference." Linda glanced at her watch. They had an hour to hike back to where they were going to rendezvous with Mark and the pig. After reporting that they'd struck out with Bumford, she was going to tell Max their best course of action now was to pre-stage the pig to Juan's location in the hope that the chairman had had better luck. "Come on, Link," she said. "Dr. Bumford, thank you for your time. And I don't think I need to remind you that we were never here." "Yes, of course," the scholar said. "By the way, have you found any sign of the rest of my team?" Linda bit back a barb about his concern for the others being an afterthought. "One of the men is dead, either Greg Chaffee or Mike Duncan. Single gunshot to the head. The vultures didn't leave enough to make an ID. We don't know about the other two." "Dear God, is it safe for me to remain here? Maybe I should return to the States." Link grabbed her arm before she decked the Ottoman scholar. "Easy, girl. He ain't worth it. Let's go." The two of them slipped out the back of the tent and made their way across the quiet camp. Neither noticed the small figure of a boy who'd listened to the conversation by crouching at the side of the tent. He waited until the pair disappeared over a sand embankment before scampering away to find the Tunisian representative. 20 minutes later, the information was passed on to a contact in Tripoli for a healthy sum of money, and a further 40 minutes after that, the turbines of an MI-8 helicopter at a remote mountaintop training camp began to shriek.